Welcome back to Success Made Last. I'm Rick Tocchini. Our very special guest today is Ken Sunshine. He is a space technology entrepreneur, senior executive, co-founder of a company, board member, a mentor, and an angel investor. Ken, welcome to Success Made to Last.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be with you this morning.
Yes, sir. We appreciate you being on and would love to know a little bit more about your career journey, starting with where did you grow up?
I grew up in a town called Great Neck, New York, about a half hour east of Manhattan, and basically, stayed there through high school, and then went to Boston for college. So I never really moved back to New York after college, but spent most of my time on the East Coast until just about 8 or 9 years ago when I moved out to the West Coast, which is where I'm at right this moment.
Excellent. And where did you start work after you completed school at the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania?
Sure. Well, actually, just taking a very quick step back even before that, just to sort of lay the background, I graduated from college as an engineer. So I actually went to Draper Labs for 4 years as an engineer. And at that point, I was trying to decide what the next move in my career should be. And I was actually thinking of a bunch of different things, but the thing that interested me most was actually being an astronaut. And then I met some astronauts at that point, including Harrison Schmitt, the second to last man on the moon. And one of the things he told me is, space needs specialists, but it also needs generalists. It needs people that understand a lot of different aspects of business and art and science and math and how those pieces all fit together. So I ultimately decided not to apply for the astronaut corps and instead applied to business school. And that's when I went to Wharton. Came out of Wharton 2 years later and went to a company called Orbital Sciences. I was employee number 28 at the time, and we grew the company. I was there for about 12 or 13 years. We grew the company to 5,000 people during the span of time that I was there. Took it public, reached a valuation, high valuation, raised a lot of money, probably raised about $2 billion in capital for various projects. So it was a really interesting ride. Orbital ended up, after I left, merging with ATK, and then ultimately was merged into Northrop Grumman. So the Orbital name itself, it's not a standalone company anymore, but that was a great experience.
That is truly amazing. If you, with that particular leg of your journey, how involved were you in the actual presentations to help raise $2 billion?
Oh, I was a part of a very small team that was really doing all this work. It was myself and the CFO, of course, the CEO, and then our legal team. We had three lawyers in-house. So really, we were a small team that was off doing due diligence and financial modeling and figuring out the deal structures. And then when we needed to, for some of the large projects, going out and raising money we had two large satellite projects. One was communications-based and one was Earth observation. Basically, photography from space, and we needed to raise hundreds of millions of dollars for those projects. It was a small core team, and then other people would be brought in. So I was pretty involved. There was a lot of work to do for a relatively small number of people.
When you look back on that experience, what do you think was the tipping point of why investors put the money up? Was it the fact that you had a scientific, unique selling proposition, patents, no one else was doing it? What do you point that trust, at least the trust inflection point toward?
I think Orbital was a pretty unique company. It was one of the first companies to break out of the large aerospace and defense mold and basically as a startup try to do big exciting things. And it started with a single project that it went out and raised $50 million for, which at the time was one of the largest private equity deals that had been done in the space sector. And I think that probably laid the foundation for a certain amount of trust in the company. But I think one of the big differentiators was the company was ahead of its time and had a really great vision. It was almost too far out in front of the time in terms of the technology was just barely there to do the things that we wanted to do. Things have changed a lot in the last 15 years. And we can talk about that too, if you want to, but Orbital was definitely a company with a great vision and we were able to demonstrate, exciting projects that could offer potentially huge economic rewards to investors. And we were able to get the deals done.
Yeah. When you look back now, Ken, and you were an aspiring astronaut, and now you look at how you have succeeded to grow a company like that and way beyond that with what you're doing currently, how do you kind of size up your personal success?
Well, I think what I've tried to do consistently throughout my career is to follow my passion, which has always been space and space technology and space related, whether it was actually going into space or whether it was putting up satellites that did really interesting things and provided a value added service back here on the ground. As long as it was connected to space, I was pretty much interested. So I've touched a lot of different types of projects and worked for different types of companies, but I've kept consistent in terms of staying close to that passion. I only stepped outside of aerospace once to co-found a medical device company, and that was just an offer that was put in front of me, basically landed on my lap, and it was too good of an offer to say no to. But other than that one time, it's been basically consistency, staying, you know, true to your passion, and maybe the other component is persistence. As one example, the company we were just talking about, Orbital, I was, you know, a young, fresh out of business school kid, basically, and that was the one company I decided I wanted to work for. And they weren't looking to hire somebody like me. So I just kept after them. I knew a couple of people there, and I would call them and call them and call them. And finally, they just said, "We're going to bring you in for an interview just so you stop calling." And they ultimately didn't need an MBA with an interest in marketing and entrepreneurial management, which is what I had studied in business school. And I still remember the CEO said to me, "Well, Ken, you know, everybody here seems to like you, and we'd like to bring you on board, but we need some gray hairs for marketing. We need we're a very young company. We need to bring in experienced marketing people. But you went to Wharton, so why don't you go into corporate finance?" And that's actually how my career took that pivot. I wanted to work for the company, so I said, "Sure, I'll try finance out." And basically, I stuck with finance ever since. So, and operations to some extent now, and, you know, in more recent years, sort of transitioning to more COO roles, but. That was actually something that changed my career, but also kept me very close to the things that I felt passionate about.
Absolutely. Love what you said. That's by your explanation, I can tell that you have balanced your priorities and understood where you needed to go, and you stuck with your domain. You become a master of your domain. And inside that, were there mentors that helped you along in the aerospace industry, or was it more mentoring on the financial side that you sought out?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think if I were to change something in my career, I would have been more proactive in explicitly forming mentor relationships. None of the relationships that, and I had some great relationships, and I'll talk a little bit about, you know, they were basically mentors, but we never called it that. And I never sought to formally view it that way, but I did have people that took me in under their wing. At Orbital itself, I would say there were two CFOs that I worked for during my tenure there, and then spent a lot of time with the CEO as well. And I think the combination of, you know, being handed a lot of responsibility early on, and sort of testing what I could do, and a lot of guidance from them, and actually in large part, rather than guidance, a lot of it was me just sitting back and watching and learning. You know, you always hear people say you learn a lot more on the job than you do in school. And honestly, that's I think that's very true. Several years at Orbital probably taught me a lot more than my couple of years in business school. But business school did lay the foundation, so I'm not knocking MBAs. Programs, and certainly not Wharton, but you learn a lot on the job. So I had those three at Orbital that I would say taught me the most, because I was, you know, fresh out of school and had a lot to learn, and really between what they had me working on and what I was able to just sit in on and observe and learn was invaluable.
And you are now this renowned a board member, and you're mentoring others, and you are an angel investor. Did you have a mentor to become a board member?
No, that's just, well, it started when I was actually at Orbital, because we had acquired several companies over the course of time, and I got involved in being on the board of one of those subsidiaries, and also spent a lot of time with our own board meetings at Orbital, mm-hmm. which were pretty intense events. You know, we had, I forget exactly how big the board was, but 10 or 12 people, very senior, you know, very senior, well-respected people, including the astronaut Harrison Schmidt that I mentioned earlier on the call. So it was, you know, very powerful group. And then you had all the senior executives from Orbital, and I played a very small role in those meetings, but I learned a lot about board governance and the process and how things should be done. And then I sat on some other boards, again, related to the companies that I was. So I was an inside board member rather than an independent, you know, outside director, but got to do that a few times. So I've just learned a lot through those experiences, and then was able to translate that into external board opportunities. I still think I've got, you know, more to learn, and I'd like to expand that part of my career down the road a little bit and spend more time on some boards. But right now I'm balancing my time. You know, I've got a day job. I've just jumped into another startup. I'm COO at a company called Pixel Space Technologies, and it's an Earth observation, Earth, you know, satellite imagery company. So that's keeping me pretty busy, but I am still mentoring and sitting on a couple of boards, because I like to stay connected to that, you know, that part of the ecosystem.
You bet. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the aerospace race between countries, and I know that you can only speak a certain amount to this because it may require breaching your government clearances, et cetera. But would you assess for us what the aerospace race looks like in layman terms? And in your opinion, are we winning the aerospace race if there is one?
Sure. Good question. And it's a complicated one, and I'm not sure there's a simple answer to it. space has evolved a lot since we first landed on the moon over 50 years ago. So you now have multiple countries that are spacefaring nations. And that includes Japan and India and Russia, of course. And there's a multiple other countries that have launched small rockets, several that have sent astronauts to the space station. So there's quite a few spacefaring nations at this point, and there's more that are aspiring to develop those capabilities. Whether it's an actual race or not, I mean, I don't think it falls into the category of a race the way it did when it was us versus the Russians, you know, trying to get to the moon. That was clearly, you know, back and forth. You know, we would achieve something. They got into space first with, you know, their first little satellite, and after that it turned into this race, and we ultimately won the race, which was great, although a lot of people would say that we didn't really capitalize on that and that we lost a lot of momentum after we landed on the moon and discontinued that program. But back to your question, so I think largely what's happened is space has become an industry where you can demonstrably do things and make money. You can garner investment from VCs and debt investors and others and raise the capital you need and build complicated systems and then actually make money. And that's been largely focused in telecommunications and satellite imagery. And then you've got separately from the business side of things, you've got what governments tend to do, like NASA for the US, which is to build things that aren't necessarily commercially driven, like the space station, although ultimately there are commercial benefits and spin-off technologies. So I think at this point, what you've got is a lot of countries looking at that whole arena, that whole marketplace, and saying, well, I want a piece of that too. And ultimately, I think it's pretty clear that space is an area that needs to be made available really to all countries. I mean, we don't own the moon in the U.S. We don't own, orbits circling the entire globe. It's really a shared resource, and it needs to be viewed that way. And it has been. Treaties that have been set up about the moon since the Apollo era have all been based on international cooperation. And so I think you'll see more and more countries jumping in, especially with what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years, where advances in everything from batteries to materials to computer chips have led to vastly less expensive, smaller satellites, which in turn have lowered launch costs because smaller launch vehicles or ride shares, they call it, where you put multiple satellites on a single launch vehicle, have become viable. So you can do things now that used to cost hundreds of millions of dollars for a fraction of that. So that's opening it up to not only a broader section of the U.S. market, including universities and small businesses and startups, but it's making it viable for both governments and commercial operations around the world. So not a race per se, I think just a global resource, and we're finally seeing it being globally developed on a larger scale.
It is so interesting. And is it true that Pixel, what you're trying to accomplish is building out a constellation of small satellites to basically create a new data set? Is that the game?
Yeah, exactly. We're going to be putting our first satellite up before the end of the year. Ultimately, we'll have 30 or more. And the reason why you put up, well, so let me just, to be clear, we're not communications. We are satellite imagery. We're flying a little bit under the radar, so we don't talk too much about exactly what makes our imagery special. But but I can tell you that it's not the type of thing that's widely available at the both the quality and the price point that we'll be offering. So it will be a little bit of a game changer. But the reason why you put up so many satellites is you get a faster revisit time. As these satellites are in different orbits and circling the Earth, if you only have one satellite, it could be days or even longer before you fly back over a certain place to take a follow-up picture. And that's frequently a very important aspect of operating a satellite imagery service is revisit time. So we'll put up a constellation. They are small satellites, very inexpensive. So we, again, are going to be doing things that would have cost well more than an order of magnitude, more than we'll be spending, probably two or three orders of magnitude. So, so yeah, that's Pixel, and it's a really interesting opportunity. Been doing that for several months now, and we're about to close the funding round, so it's really exciting times.
It sounds extremely exciting. You're the only entrepreneur that we've ever talked to on Success Made to Last in this aerospace domain. And we find it totally fascinating because you're following some of the same basic things. You found a pain point within your industry and you're addressing it. You're having to create a pitch to investors, except that you're in outer space versus, you know, boots on the ground. But some of the things, right. Some of the same theories apply. And I would love to close out today's show by you giving some advice to entrepreneurs that are not necessarily in aerospace, but who are mm-hmm. who are looking at startups and who are trying to come up with a solution to a problem and be unique in the marketplace so they can in turn raise funds and you know, eventually build out their enterprise and sell it or keep it or do something with it. But what's your advice today to young entrepreneurs listening about how to focus their energies and resources properly?
Sure, that's a great question. And if I had the whole answer, you know, I'd probably be writing books and starting. You know, lots of multi-billion-dollar unicorns. That is kind of what I'm trying to do now. A few things in terms of what to do. That, without getting into the specifics of the idea, because ideas are different in every sector. Different ideas are going to be what succeed. So it depends on what they're doing and what industry they're in. But once you think you have an idea, I think perhaps one of the most important things is to identify the minimum viable product that you can go to market with. Part of what investors have a hard time with is if you come to them with a large, complex vision that involves a lot of moving pieces with multiple products that need to be rolled out over a long period of time. That's a difficult scenario. What you really want is what is the minimum viable product, the least expensive, least complicated approach to solving the problem I'm looking to solve. And that becomes your first generation. That's what you go to market with. That's where you raise your money. Then you can go back and start adding the bells and whistles, the next generation, the third generation after that. Even spin-offs and sort of related parts of your product or your technology you can roll out at a later time. But stay focused, build your MVP, and then the other thing to keep in mind, perseverance is hugely important. And I think most entrepreneurs know that. Most people in startups know it's going to be a long process and it's a lot of hard work. But what's really important, and it's especially timely right now, is and it ties to the minimum viable product. Part of what the minimum viable product gives you is it lowers your burn rate your cash burn rate to the lowest possible level. That's really what, especially right now in these times, you need to stretch your money out as far as you possibly can. The hardest thing to do is to go back to your investors and say you need more and that you didn't achieve the plan.
Right.
The plan needs to be modified. So I think those are the key things to focus on. And really a laser-like focus on those things and then grow. Once you achieve that, then you can start thinking about how to expand and layer on, as I said, the bells and the whistles.
Well, Ken, thank you so much for being on our show today. We really appreciate it. And stay in touch with us. And we thank you for you sharing your wisdom today on Success Made to Last.
Well, I enjoyed it, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. That was Ken Sunshine. We appreciate him being on our Success Made to Last show today. And as we always say here, may you live the best version of you. Have a great week. So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasine@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program. And thanks to our sponsor, Gracefully Yours greeting cards and their hilarious Church Kitchen Lady cards. Church Kitchen Ladies are a bunch of maybe 20 million volunteers across the United States that work in 300,000 churches, and they say stuff like, mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. They also say, crunch tacos, not abs. And psst, you're crazy is showing, you might want to tuck that back in. And one of our favorites is, life is short, lick the bowl. If you want to find out more about the wonderful Church Kitchen Ladies and join their roundtable, go to gracefully-yours.com today and find out about Church Kitchen Ladies and purchase all the rest of the fine Gracefully Yours greeting cards.